Just first off, to relate my story, if I can use that terminology, quote unquote, I don't think it's standard, and I believe I'm an extremely fortunate individual. And over the years, I've spoken to various audiences like yourselves, audience like college students, high school students, etc., and different people take different things out of the talk, hopefully. One thing I will say is I definitely will leave time for questions at the end. The questions tend to be, for me at least, tend to be more interesting because I've heard myself speak before. So that to me is not as interesting as hearing what's on your mind. But in the meantime, I do want to go over kind of where I've come from, how I came here today to Chicago, and give you a little bit of an understanding of some of the decisions that were part of my life and have got me to this point in my career and in my life. Anyway, I was born back in 1957, and you could do the math, in Brooklyn, New York. And my parents were Holocaust survivors. My mother was in Auschwitz. She's an Auschwitz survivor, and she's alive today, the age of 80, spends every Shabbat in our house, just about every single one, and spends usually actually 2 or 3 days a week in our house, functions very, very well. But as you can imagine, growing up as a child, one of the children of the survivors, a second generation, if we can call it that, there's a certain drive in your life that's not discussed in the house, but somehow there's a message of the importance of living a meaningful life. I felt my parents really had given me and gave me that, and I think to some degree may explain some of the things that went on subsequent. I have a Jewish day school education in New York. I grew up and went to the Yeshiva Flatbush, a very well-known day school in the New York City and Brooklyn, New York City area, and graduated from there in 1975. And then, in probably the most important decision I've made in my life, I decided to spend a year in Israel at that point. Now, today, it is not unusual for people to travel abroad to spend a year or even longer learning in Jewish studies, going to yeshiva, as it's called, and sometimes spend many years. When my parents allowed me and funded me to go to Israel for a year, it was not that popular back in 75 to do that. Yet, I had felt the need to be able to grow in my commitment to Judaism. While I grew up in a modern Orthodox home, I still believe, like probably many high school students, I approached my Jewish studies much more as a class. Now, it was a more positive experience than many of you may have had in a Hebrew school environment, which probably has turned off more Jews to Judaism than anything else in the last 50 years in America. But I believe that's actually being today regentrified into a much more positive form than it used to be. There actually is today a network of Hebrew schools that have been developed that there's actually students are going to and enjoying that after-school experience. But when I grew up, the experience of Hebrew school was, I think, anathema to many Jewish youth. My experience in the day school was a much more positive one, but still I view Judaism much more something as I kind of did because my parents did it and I wanted to do well on exams, etc., but I didn't understand really where the connection was. And I went to Israel, I went to a yeshiva called Bet Midrash Torah in Jerusalem, no longer exists today. And that year really did change my life because it refocused myself to the importance of what Judaism was all about, that there really was something about trying to connect to God. And there really is something to all these books and texts that I had been learning through high school that there really appeared to be more than what was presented to me as an exam. And I started to love to learn. And it was an area that I saw myself really wanting to try to grow because I believe that would express relationship in my life as far as being able to relate A, to God, B, to the Jewish people, and third, to the world as a whole. I returned after that year and went to Queens College and got two degrees, a degree in accounting and a co-major in economics, and stayed in public accounting long enough to get my CPA, and then went on to business school to the Wharton School of Business, University of Pennsylvania in 1980. And all the while going through that, I actually had the good fortune of marrying my current wife for 27 years, Devorah. We got married in 1979, and we moved down to Philly together and had our first son, Yair, while I was in business school. Now, when I went to business school, I really wasn't sure what I was going to turn into. You know, I'd gone down there, I was very happy in public accounting, and I could have very easily stayed in that field. Fortunately, when I took the GMATs and I did reasonably well on them, my wife, my mother-in-law, were a lot smarter than me and gave me this very good advice and said, you know, you can always come back and be an accountant. Why stay in the field today? Take the 2 years, invest in yourself. Me, I had difficulty understanding why I wanted to spend $10,000 a year to go to graduate school. But the smarter heads prevailed, and I ended up going down to Wharton. Now, what was very interesting, and this is somewhat hard for many of you probably to relate to, is what the economic environment was in the United States in 1980 and why business school may have not been viewed as the most attractive alternative, and the investment business may have been viewed as almost the least attractive alternative coming out of business school in the early 1980s. A little bit of history, and I apologize, but I do enjoy economics and I do enjoy economic history. If you go back to the environment that existed in 1980, the United States came out of an economy that was unquestionably the worst economy that existed here till from the period of the Depression, the 1930s, till the mid-70s, had really been a period of generally good economic times. And then the combination of high inflation, high interest rates, high unemployment, what was known as stagflation in that days, and a very poorly run, at least from an economic perspective, administration under Jimmy Carter, led to a scenario in 1980 where we were faced with basically a double-dip recession, which went on during my term in business school, and an environment where interest rates were 20%, which is an incredible number you think back to that. Inflation was roughly 10-11%, and unemployment was 10-11%. Anybody from my era remembers the 1980 election. And the reason Ronald Reagan won that election, I believe, was one slide. You know, sometimes I think we all try to capture something. And Ronald Reagan captured our economic plight so well. He had what was called the misery index, which was you added inflation plus unemployment, which I think is a pretty good number. And that came out to like 20-some-odd percent. And we had never had those kind of numbers in this country. And he said, you know, how do you feel? And I think everybody felt miserable. And that's how, you know, people voted for him. Plus, you know, he did a few other things that were phenomenal, frankly. But I think that message really resonated with the American voter and had a lot to do with the election of Republican president in 1980. Anyway, so I went to business school, and I was concerned about getting a job after business school. I was a finance major, didn't know what I was going to go into, but I did like the investment management business a little bit. I knew because I kind of traded my own account for a couple of years, like any guy coming out of college, trying to make a lot of money on oil stocks. But the last time oil stocks were as hot as they are today was back in the late 70s, early 1980s, and you know every little drill that was being drilled in the overthrust belt out in the Rocky Mountain areas, they used to have all these penny stocks, used to invest in these kind of stocks. I learned very quickly how not to make money in the stock market while I was working before going to business school. Anyway, comes 1982, went through the experience in Wharton, was a great experience, and went through the interview process, had job offers in a number of different fields, in corporate finance, in investment banking, and yet I had really had an extremely positive interview experience with Fidelity Investments. Now, today, everybody knows who Fidelity is, and in the 1960s, everybody knew who Fidelity was, but in 1982, Fidelity was not a well-known name. What do I mean by that? In 1966, the Dow Jones passed the 1,000 mark. That's like, the different level of people knowing what the indices are. I'll try to explain, but not try to dumb this down, you know, too much. The Dow Jones crossed 1,000 in 1966. In 1982, when I joined the investment business, the Dow Jones was 780. So basically, over a 16-year period, if you had kind of bought the market, you'd have lost 22%. Now, if you adjust that to the fact that we were living in a time with high inflation and take that down to real dollars, you would actually lost two-thirds of your money if you invested in the stock market during that time period. So, you could have alternatively put your money in a basically no risk money market fund, and you were getting like, you know, 12, 13, 14% a year in the late 70s, early 80s. So you could see why the investment management business may have not been an attractive business to go into in 1982. I will tell you that Fidelity was one of three buy side being the investor side, three buy side firms that interviewed on campus at Wharton. T. Rowe Price, and I think Cap Research in LA was the third. Fidelity that year extended one, they had two guys from the summer who worked in the summer of 81 who they got full-time jobs, and they extended one offer. I happened to have been the lucky guy for their class of 82 because nobody was hiring in the business because it was, you know, there was no growth. Nobody was putting money in there. Fidelity's equity under management had shrunk from $4 billion in 1966 also to $3 billion in 1982. This is such an unattractive business. It was kind of like going to the steel business today in the United States. Like, steel business actually is not so bad today, but the steel business was terrible the last 20 years. So, but yet, when I interviewed at Fidelity, I found the environment there to be incredibly invigorating. I felt it was going to be the ultimate meritocracy, and everybody I spoke to there absolutely was in love with stocks and the stock market. They live and they breathe the investment process, and it just sang to me. So decided to take that offer, and you mentioned Peter Lynch before. So Peter Lynch was the last interview I had. I had three rounds of interview, one on campus and two afterwards. So the last interview I had, and it was up at Fidelity, was with Peter Lynch. Now, Peter was running Magellan. Magellan was probably $500 million at that time. When I left Magellan in 1992, it was $20 billion, to give you a different idea of some of the numbers. But it was like about $500 million. Now, Peter's in his office, and he had a pretty good-sized office, and he had probably 1,000 files all over the place. I've never seen a place more. I mean, they were kind of organized files, but they were all over the walls. It's pretty intimidating. So I'm sitting there at a desk, and he's kind of right across from me, and he asked me, I am not exaggerating, at least 25 questions in 30 minutes. And what do you know about the steel industry? What do you know about all these different industries? A little bit of accounting questions. He's going on and on. Incredibly intimidating. But if you think that was bad, what was worse was at the same time as he's doing that, he's on the Quotron machine. They used to have what's called Quotrons. They're called Bloomberg's today. So he's on the Quotron. He's on the phone with his trader, trading stocks. There were analysts walking in and out, you know, buy this, sell, whatever. All this, it was... I walked out of there with such a splitting headache. I flew back to Philly, and my wife was working at Pennsylvania Hospital. I got back. It's like 4:30 in the afternoon. She comes home. I'm in bed in pajamas. She goes, "What happened?" I said, "I blew it." And I said, "I was just horrible. Oh, don't ask." And 5 days later, they called. So I was very fortunate. Anyway, I was fortunate, by the way, for a second reason. And this is one of the messages I want to tell you about. The incredible fortunate part about my life, and the reason maybe that I'm here today, is to some degree you can call it an accident of timing. You know, you never know what God has planned for you in the world. If I had had that interview 10 years earlier to the day, and started Fidelity in July of 72. If I was still doing the same thing in July of 82 at Fidelity, I would have started 10 years before then. That would have been a success story because most people were laid off. If you speak to people in the investment business, almost nobody was hired in the business from like 1972 to 1978. There's like a gap of 6 years, like the years of plenty and the years of famine. There was 7 years of famine in the investment business in the 1970s. I was extremely fortunate. I walked into literally what turned into the hottest investment place, which got all the press in the 80s, into a great situation where they didn't have enough bodies to start handling all the money that came in. And I got onto this track that was an incredible fast track that pushed me way ahead of where I should have been at that time. And I really went through what you can call career compression. And career compression helped stimulate some of the other decisions that I'll speak about in a few minutes. Started in 1982, and I started as an analyst, and I started doing the gambling industry, the lodging industry, and all the housing related industries. So I understand the subprime mortgage business a little bit, and I do understand the housing industry quite a bit from my background. And I was very fortunate because in 1982, we were coming off a very severe recession and interest rates were dropping significantly. And anybody knows anything about housing stocks, the time to own housing stocks is when rates are dropping dramatically and no one's been building houses for a few years. And that was the environment. We had gone from about 2 million housing starts in 1978 to about 800,000 housing starts in 1982. So when rates collapsed and houses, you know, and these home builders are very leveraged to any upturn in business, the stocks did phenomenal. So people thought I was, you know, I knew what I was doing. The truth was I had the right industries. My stock picks worked out great. The gambling business was great then. It was just when Atlantic City was starting. The first stock I recommended at Fidelity was Golden Nugget, Steve Wynn's old company. Steve Wynn has gone through a number of iterations since that point, but the stock went up fivefold in 9 months. It was nothing to do with me. It's just that the business took off like crazy, etc. Anyway, after a year, they made me an assistant on the Fidelity Fund, which was kind of like a plain vanilla fund. They did that for about 9 months, and then after having been there for 21 months, I had a chance to start managing money for the first time of my life and ran this Fidelity Select Fund. Now, was I equipped to do this job? The answer is absolutely not. I didn't have enough experience, but frankly, they didn't have enough people. And we were very much a believer of hiring internally. and building people through the Fidelity system. The Fidelity does have a way of looking kind of very research-oriented, especially back in those days, very, very oriented to calling companies, visiting companies. So I started to manage a fund with $500,000 of seed capital. Managed to lose about 8% in about 3 weeks, by the way. Did that again. And they got a little nervous, I think, but things kind of straightened out pretty quickly. And I was getting incredibly fortunate. Why? In the mid-80s was the first real merger and acquisition wave in the media companies. Media and the whole Michael Milken, Drexel Burnham era began back in the early mid-80s. And a lot of the companies that I was doing research on were cash flow machines, companies that could be leveraged up, could be bought out, etc. So all these stocks started to do really, really well. And I was a big fan of the cable industry. Cable industry did phenomenally well back in the 1980s. And the fund took off like crazy. Had a great record, and was again, I think, very fortunate, and grew to about $350 million by the summer of '86. So now I've been at Fidelity for 4 years, and Paul Stuka is running the Fidelity OTC fund, which has been in existence now for 18 months. It started the end of 1984, decides to leave Fidelity. In 18 months, that fund had grown to $1 billion, and they asked me to take it over. So what did I know about over-the-counter stocks? Exactly zero. And that's not an exaggeration, because if you look at the composition of what the over-the-counter market was in the mid-80s, it consisted primarily of financial stocks, which included insurance companies, banks, etc., technology stocks, and healthcare. Those were by far the largest industry groups in the over-the-counter market. And I had exactly zero experience in any of those industries, because the 2 years prior, I was doing leisure stocks. Well, leisure included media, basically all the consumer groups. I knew consumer groups really, really well, but I didn't know anything about technology. So took over $1 billion fund not knowing what I'm doing, and decided I better learn about technology. Now, I didn't know anything about technology. And I'm the kind of guy who had a black and white TV in my house still of like the mid-80s. I mean, I just, there's an article about me that discusses that in Money Magazine. If you go back far enough, you'll find it. But I didn't know much about technology. So I did what any good analyst should do. I made 6 one-week trips to California in the space of 1 year. And lived in Silicon Valley to some extent, and really learned about distributed processing. Now, everybody, we live by distributed processing today. What do I mean by distributed processing? It means that on your desktop, you have an enormous amount of power. Anybody who's a little bit older here knows that in the old days, we had a bunch of dumb terminals that did nothing. And the change over from dumb terminals to distributed processing to power at the desktop was one of those mega changes that really dictated what happened in technology through the 80s and early 90s before the internet became the next major chapter in technology. And I was lucky because I had no prior history. I wasn't married to the old DEX and mini computers and IBM, etc. So I kind of went to visit, spoke to Microsoft, visited all these distributed processing companies, Sun Microsystems, and I said, boy, this makes a lot of sense. Like, why wouldn't people, this is where the whole world's going to. So I ended up investing in a lot of these companies, and they did great, and I was very fortunate because I didn't have that prior history. Now, it's impossible to discuss the 4 years that I ran the over-the-counter fund without discussing the crash of 87, which was truly an incredible event that anybody who's not in the business the last 20 years has not experienced it. It was really unique. Somewhat akin to 1929, and the difference is I'm around to speak about it. A lot of people who went through the crash of 29 did not survive it to speak about it afterwards, and I mean that literally took their lives. The crash of 87 was as scary as you can imagine, and I have to extrapolate that to today to give you an understanding of what that means. The market, as you may or may not know, had a great run through the 80s from the time period that I started. As I mentioned, the market was roughly 780 in 1982. It hit 2,700, which is about 3 to 3.5 times in 1987, which is a disproportionate return for stocks over such a short time period. But what was more upsetting is that interest rates had really started to rise in the 86-87 period for a number of different factors, including inflation starting to grow, and interest rates hit 9% in 1987. And the confluence of those events, plus the fact that there was so much money being managed on Wall Street through trading programs, caused that while the markets rose at incredible paces through this period, once the tide turned, it started to turn, but it turned with a vengeance. Because there were none of those circuit breakers that exist in the market. Today, the market goes down a couple hundred points, they put on a circuit breaker. Another couple hundred points is another circuit breaker. These circuit breakers actually work. And, you know, it's very funny. When they were first enacted, a lot of people were saying, it's, you know, another kind of gimmick. It's not a gimmick. It helps to rationalize markets over short time periods when an irrational market could just basically take down the entire system, and which is what basically happened in 1987. The week before the crash was October 19th, the market had a terrible, terrible week. The market went down probably by 10-15% that week. Now, I recall that week very clearly because that was a week where the Jewish holidays were falling out. The last set of holidays over the holiday of Sukkot fell out that Thursday and Friday. So I was not in the office. And, I'll speak a little bit about, obviously how interacting was being an Orthodox Jew in the workplace was. But, when I was not in the office, I was not available. I had a very good trader who knew what to do in my portfolio, and he knew as we were getting redemptions in our funds, he knew to sell stocks and did it a very rational basis. But basically, the week before the crash, the market was getting hit pretty bad. But the day of the crash, the market went down by 22%. And the only reason it went down just 22% that day is that the bell rang at 4 o'clock. In other words, if the bell had not rang, the market would have still gone down. And I am not exaggerating that point. It was an orderly 22% decline. It kept on going down. It's like the chart wouldn't have ended. 4 o'clock stopped it. And again, to give you an understanding of what that means, that would be like you would wake up tomorrow morning and the Dow would be down 3,000 points. Now think about it, that would go from 13,000 to 10,000. That would be like unbelievable. Like this would be like incredible. And that's how incredible it was for us. Now, as bad as the 19th was, the 20th was worse. And the 20th was, without a question, the scariest day in the U.S. economic history since the crash of 29. Why do I say that? The markets opened up about 100 points and then start to slide. And about 11 o'clock that morning, basically, the brokerage system in America was bankrupt because of all the markdowns that had occurred the last week and a half. And they had no capital to put up for you to buy 5,000 shares or even 1,000 shares of IBM. Now, you remember that Quotron machine I mentioned 10 or 15 minutes ago? So one of the things with the Quotron machine was that whenever a stock traded, it would blink. So you know a stock trades. So IBM trades, you see blink, Boeing, BA, you got it blink. Okay. It's 11 o'clock in the morning. It's not a holiday. It's not like Veterans Day or some other day. And you're looking at your screen, and like nothing's happening because you couldn't trade a stock. And it's the most incredible experience I've ever seen in my life. Like you thought the U.S. financial system was in, and it was, by the way, in a meltdown. And what unstuck the system at that point, what happened is that the Fed decided that they were going to become the lender of last resort for all the brokerage houses and basically said, don't worry, we're not marking you to market tonight. You can provide capital and feel free to use our windows, etc. And that basically got rid of the logjam that existed and people started to trade again. And thank God we lived to tell about that story, but it was scary. I will tell you two side stories that I called my wife. I forget if that was on Monday or Tuesday, which day I called her. The crash was Monday, but the day after was Tuesday. I forgot which day I called her. I called her. I asked her to go down to our local Bay Bank, no longer exists, Bay Bank branch, and go down and get $1,000 out of the money machine and just take the money and put it in the house. I wanted to have $1,000 of cash. She said, what good is that going to do you? I said, I don't care. Just get $1,000. The second funny story is that my liquid cash was in Fidelity. So me and a very good friend of mine, Richard Fenton, who was running another one of our funds, showing our express confidence in Fidelity, went down to our money window, took out all of our money out of our money market accounts, walked across the street to Charlotte Bank, which was an FDIC-insured bank, and put all of our money in the FDIC-insured bank. That's how scary it was. We didn't know if our firm was going to make it or if anyone was going to make it. Anyway, we survived. Markets did great. So on and so forth. 1990 comes. I've been doing this for 4 years. And suddenly Peter Lynch decides he's going to retire. Peter Lynch was 47 years old when he decided to retire. And he retired, I believe, primarily because his father had died from a heart attack at that same age. And I think that had a major impact on his life. And I think that he was concerned about that. And, he'd been running money for a long time. And he really wanted to reshift where he was spending his time. And that was a tremendous shock to all of us at Fidelity. But the other shock for me on a personal basis was they asked me to take over the fund. Now, I do not believe I was the most qualified person to take over that fund. And I don't believe that there's a false sense of modesty and stuff like that. I truly believe there are other people who would have been more competent to take it over. But whatever the reasons, they asked me to do it, and I wasn't sure I wanted to take it over because this was going to thrust me into the public in a way I could never possibly imagine. Now, when Peter left, the fund was $13 billion, had the top 5-year, 10-year, 15-year record, and it was like, you know, Michael Jordan retiring. You know, that's all I could describe. We're in Chicago, what can I tell you? And it was big news. And it was the front page, you know, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, all the news shows, etc. And I went home with my wife, discussed it. We decided this was one of those once-in-a-lifetime situations that, you know, God puts you into. And there was definitely a message to me in this. And I felt like I kind of had to do it. So we decided we're going to take the position, and we did that. And as alluded to before, I started the position in July of 90, and that preceded the two significant events. The first Iraqi war with Kuwait broke out in August 2nd, I believe, of 1990, and the last great U.S. real estate crisis was unfolding at that time period. Now, I was really very well aware of the real estate crisis because I've been doing over-the-counter stocks for many years, and I had visited so many regional banks who had so much bad commercial real estate on their portfolio. So that was not a shock to yours truly. The reason we understood that was because we lived in New England, and the first market to go down in commercial real estate was the New England market in 1986 because it was a gross amount of overbuilding, and you could literally predict what's going to happen in the rest of the United States. Anyway, so the combination of those two factors caused a real difficult market correction that summer. The market went down by 20%. Magellan went down by about 21 or 22% in that same period. And as I've said to many people, Peter, when he gave me over the Peter Lynch, when he gave me over the fund, gave me a little piece of paper showing that in the time period he had run the fund, there were 10 market corrections of 10% or more at every single one. He had underperformed the market in that market correction. So I was very proud to keep that record up. Anyway, so what happened is that there's, you know, some negative press started to develop that fall because the fund's down by a lot. The fund's down to $10 billion in size. And, you know, I'm doing my best. And the Boston Globe decides it has it out for me. And they start to run a Morris Smith watch looking at my performance on a weekly basis with a picture of me. And don't ask, you know, with my performance, literally it's like a batting average. You know, every week how the fund did, the S&P, the Dow, and how it's been since I took over. So we got through 90, and the fund recovered some towards the end of the year. And, you know, the war with the United States began in January of 91. So you kind of had to make a bet here, whether you thought, you know, we're going to win or lose the war. And I kind of thought we were going to win the war. So the fund got really aggressively positioned in early 91. And fortunately, the day the war broke out, the market started to take off. And 1991 was a great year in the market. The market was up by 30%. The fund was up by 41%. I mean, everything was going gangbusters. The Boston Globe stopped running this stupid thing every week, and they wrote a nice column after a year, and USA Today was happy. Everybody was happy. You know, Fidelity was happy, so on and so forth. And then 92 rolls around, and the fund's doing well. We're having a good year. We're pretty happy with the results. And yet, you know, I've been there 10 years now, so let me take a step back. I've been working at Fidelity for 10 years. I'd had this incredible career compression where I'd gone from basically starting as an analyst and had done everything that was possible on a professional basis within the investment management world. And it was taking a toll on me. You know, I was working 70 hours a week at that point, 60 hours probably running OTC, but 70 running Magellan. And I was the type of person who had other interests in my life, so I could take a step back. I've often been asked what was it like to be an Orthodox Jew in the workplace. First of all, Fidelity was a phenomenal environment. I think I mentioned earlier in this talk that Fidelity was truly a meritocracy. I felt that way all the way. I never experienced any anti-Semitism by the firm or anything like that by companies I interacted with. All the things that I had to be sensitive, I needed them to be sensitive about as far as never working on the Sabbath. Again, I mentioned to you during the crash, etc. Never was there a question ever asked about it. And I think that's true of most employers. If they see that you are sincere and committed to what you believe in, that will no longer becomes a topic of discussion. And so that was never a problem. And yet, one thing that I felt in my life was lacking was that I didn't have as much time that I wanted to really invest as far as spending more time with the family and more time as far as doing Jewish learning. I had always, you know, I go back to what we said before, and when I went to yeshiva, I had a new appreciation of what Jewish learning was about. And all the time period from then on, I always spent time learning. People used to ask me, what did you do with Fidelity? How did you ever find time to learn when you were working so hard? So I used to go on, I used to commute by commuter rail every day. So in the morning, I used to learn from the oral text called Mishnayot every day on the train. And in addition, I used to get up early on the weekend. Sunday morning, I used to get up 6 o'clock. I had what's called the Chevruta, when you learn with another person. For 9 years, I learned with a very good friend of mine in Sharon, Massachusetts. We used to learn every Sunday morning and Saturday also on Shabbat. We used to learn also. So I worked very hard at keeping up a certain learning schedule. I spent time on my own to do it, but yet I didn't feel like I had the opportunity to invest as much as I wanted to in myself. So we came to the decision, because I mean that not just myself and my wife, we came to the decision that, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years and I really wanted a break. So I went into Fidelity and told them during the Passover holiday in 92 that I really wanted to take a leave of absence. And they were shocked because the phone was doing great, the press was great, and yet I needed to do a shift. And they spent a week trying to talk me out of it, but they understood how sincere my commitment was, that I really wanted to, rebalance my priorities. And they said, no problem. So I ended up going to Israel with my family, because another one of our great dreams that we had had since we had gotten married was to spend some time in Israel and have a chance for our children to spend time there. 1 year turned into 7 years in Israel. And my schedule did change dramatically, and it has changed till today. And this is a good way of rolling to the next part of my life. I spend probably 30 to 35 hours a week today doing Jewish education, Jewish learning. And I think it's literally, if there's one message I would want all of you to take away from here today, is I cannot tell you how important it is for yourselves and for your families, and that could be children, it could be parents, no matter how you're going to define family units, to invest in Jewish learning. You know, we're known as the people of the book. In general, I think we love reading. I think we're a reasonably intelligent group of individuals. And I gather if I went around the room here, almost every one of you have an expertise in different areas, whatever area you may be interested. And yet what is such a tragedy is that our incredible heritage that we were blessed with for the last 5,700 years, we don't know much about. And we have cheated ourselves consistently by not investing in this part that's part of all of our DNA. I mean, this is literally identifiable, as I say, with DNA today. And none of us have invested the time. And it's not like it was our fault, by the way. This is not like a guilt trip type of thing. I was lucky because my parents made a decision to send me to day school. And I was lucky because I spent a year in Israel. So I had those breaks. But most people I speak to did not have those exposures. And by the way, this is not like, there's no one to fault it. It's just the reality. A lot of people were struggling, couldn't deal with, you know, with different issues when they came over from Europe, etc., whatever the story may be. And Jewish education or the Jewish religion may have not been that paramount to them at that point. But yet when we abandon Jewish education, we abandon our heritage. And it's very hard when you're, you know, I got to tell you an interesting story. I'm sorry, I have to digress, but it's worth hearing it. 2 weeks ago on Shabbat, we had over 7 college kids from Boston. You know, there was a program in, they took them down to my area. I live in Lawrence, New York, to see what a Shabbat experience. These kids have never had a Shabbat experience. So they came to my house for lunch, and they were there till 5 in the afternoon, speaking to myself, my wife, and my children who are home. And, you know, as we were talking, I said to them, this is so unfair that you never had that experience. And, you know, they feel, I think from their own perspective, they just wish they would have had that exposure beforehand. And they were so happy that now, for the first time, they were actually learning. They have this great, it's a great program on college, I guess, very similar to what Jet's doing. Because it's on college, they do this in Boston, a couple of the universities, and they meet once a week, and they really are expanding their horizons. And no matter what level you're at, you can always grow from that level. And it's like an onion. The more levels you peel, the more depth you find behind it. So what happened to me, going back to 1992, one of the commitments I made to myself is I wanted to spend half a day learning. So I ended up going to yeshiva, and I ended up going to Yeshiva Esh HaTorah in the Old City. And I went there for probably two interesting reasons. I was able to get a lift to the Old City every day with one of my neighbors, and it was the most incredible place to be sitting to learn Torah, because you're literally sitting outside the Western Wall and the Temple Mount. You can't imagine a more inspiring scene to be able to learn Torah. One year in yeshiva turned into 7 years. I spent half of my time there, and I would spend my mornings from like 8 to 1 in yeshiva, and then the afternoons I was trading my own account. I had the 9th Bloomberg ever put in Jerusalem was in my office. I remember when they installed it, and I used to trade my account. Used to call companies. I think people who know me would say I'm very much involved in the world until today. But yet I reshifted my focus, so I spent half my time on the investment world and half the time doing Jewish learning, and that has really been my walking order since that point. And I feel this changed my life immeasurably in a number of different ways. First of all, obviously, the more you learn about something, the more valuable it is. The more I have an understanding about religion, the more I feel in touch. When I put on tefillin, phylacteries every morning, and I pray, I don't pray the same today as I did 15 years ago, because I've spent a lot of time learning about what prayer is all about, so I can identify more about what that experience is. Prayer before used to be like, oh God, let's get this over. You know, I remember being in high school like everybody else. You know, nobody wants to go through the experience. Today, it's a completely different experience for myself. I probably take as long saying today the Shmona Esrei, the main corpus, as I would used to take to say the whole prayers combined, because it's, I feel there's a relationship with God. So on one hand, it affects you because you understand more, and it affects you because you develop that relationship with God, and you develop the relationship in addition to that with the Jewish people. And we are a unique people, and we have to build on those bonds. So anyway, so I spent the time there, and then we ended up coming back from Israel after 7 years for a number of different reasons. There were some educational issues that for my children I thought would be better here versus being in Israel. And also my father passed away in 1999, and there was a responsibility that I felt towards taking care of my mother. She should be well. She's now 80 years old. So both of those factors were relevant in the decision for us to move back. And since I've been back here, I've kept up a similar schedule, but I had a time shifted to some degree. People who know me, I'm one of those people who get up very early in the morning. And so what I do today is spend half my time still, if you would call it, maybe half the... It's funny how you define your day. My days tend to be quite long, but I spend, again, 4 to 5 hours a day doing Jewish learning. I get up usually 4:30 in the morning, and I start about 4:45. And I learn a solid block from 4:45 to 7:45, and then I have prayers after that. And then I do learning, depending on the day of the week, either in the morning or the evening. Then I spend probably another third of my time on the investment business. Now, one of the nice things about the investment business is, while for about 10 years after I left Fidelity from 92 to 02, I used to trade my account very actively. The truth is today I traded very infrequently. Most of my money is out with hedge funds, and that was a gradual process. I really had no money in hedge funds in 1992. And as I got myself familiar with different money managers, friends of mine who left, you know, the mutual fund industry, went into money management, into hedge fund management themselves, and other friends I met along the way, I wanted to invest money with them. And over time, slowly but surely, that started to grow as a percent of my total portfolio, where today a significant a majority of my money is in varied hedge funds. I really have, in a sense, a personal fund of funds, I think a reasonable degree of diversification, and it has done very well for me, which stimulated really the decision on my own part to really give out more and more money so I don't have to spend less and less time on the investment process. So I have money in hedge funds, which I do stay on top of how they're doing. I serve on 5 different investment committees in the New York City area, the largest being on the investment committee of the Yeshiva University, which is close to a $2 billion endowment. And in addition to that, I do strategic financial consulting for 1 or 2 different companies. I'm on one public company board, and stay active and interested in the investment business. And then the third part of my life I spent in different public areas, different charities. And this is, again, another one of those universal messages that I do believe is from the DNA of the Jewish people. The Jewish people are an incredible charitable people. I don't have a doubt that the amount of money that we give to charity is higher than any other ethnic group in the world. And I think it really goes all the way back to our forefather Abraham. Abraham was known, his essential character trait was known as chesed, as giving to others. And that, I think, is part of, no matter what your identification is, we all want to help others. other people. And that has been a stimulus for myself as far as being involved with a number of different charities, both here and in Israel. Everyone has their pet projects. I'm involved with a number of projects related to infertility. I'm involved with a number of different projects related to supporting yeshivas, people where, you know, where people learn on a full-time basis. I am very active in my children's day school in Far Rockaway, New York. And then I have one charity that I actually run. And what I like about it is it's not a business. It's actually a 501c3, but I run it as a business. But I think it provides a wonderful service. And it goes very much back to the same topic that I discussed earlier, which is education. I run a company called Torah Conferencing Network, TCN for short, and what we do is we broadcast live classes by esteemed Torah scholars, men and women. We have 7 live classes that are given either weekly or on a monthly basis, and it's broadcast now to over 80 sites throughout the world. When I say a site, I mean it could be a synagogue, it could be a Jewish community center, it could be in a day school. We do not do it to the home for a number of reasons, maybe the most important one being that the educational experience of going to sit with in a group where you have to go out of your house to see something is very different vis-a-vis watching on the internet. Because we are internet enabled. I'll talk about the technology in a second. But the problem is, and I know this because I'm at home, when you kind of watch, do something at home, I guess I'm probably like many of you who like to multitask. I mean, I multitask my entire life. It's a miracle I haven't pulled out the BlackBerry 3 times as we're speaking, as it's buzzing in my pocket. But it's very hard to focus and concentrate. And as an organization, we have felt it's very important to get people together to learn together. The experience of learning with a second person is very different than learning with one person. The experience of learning with 5 people is very different than learning even with 2 people. So we have it delivered to all these different sites, and we've had an incredible amount of success. None of us, there's about 5 of us who were involved originally with the planning and founding of this, expected this to take off. It was a small project, and now it's turned into a large project. And what is wonderful is you can go all over the world, and people's lives have really been enhanced by the quality of this Jewish learning experience that they have had by having these great speakers speak to them on such a frequent basis. It's a project I truly love, and it's managed financially and very responsibly. Basis. I will tell you that we are cash flow positive. We do not ask for donations. We have sites that pay for the services that they receive, and it's part of their adult education budget, and it works out beautifully. And I have a tremendous amount of enjoyment working on that project. You know, it's a wonderful thing to be able to teach Torah. You know, you're exposed, for example, to the people from JET, right? I will never be a great Torah teacher. I'm a great, you know, I think I'm a great listener, a great learner, but to be able to be an enabler to let people learn Torah is a wonderful, wonderful merit that God has given me in this world. And I feel very, very fortunate to have been able to be involved in education on that level. So I want to leave you with one challenge, and then I want to open this up for questions. I was talking beforehand to some of the people and who are hosting today and sponsoring today's event, which I want to thank them for, by the way. And what I'd like to leave you is with the following question and challenge. Is I would like to know where all of you see yourself 12 months from now, and I would love to see where you see yourself committing yourself to investing in yourself, in your Jewish education over the next 12 months. That I don't think anyone should leave this talk and say, okay, that was nice, you know, I learned a little bit about Jewish education and life goes on. To me, a successful luncheon is where all of you walk out of here and say, you know what, there's something here. I've got to put some time into it, whether it's an hour a week or something more. And I'm going to make a commitment to you that I'm going to do something over the next year. Because I told Zev beforehand that if enough commitments come back, I'll come back 12 months from now and we could discuss kind of what you have done and maybe discuss other things about the investment business at the same time. But I really am interested in trying to get a commitment from people, because I think if you do that, you will all benefit. I truly believe you'll come to me and say, that was such a good idea for you have told me that. Anyway, thank you very, very much. Okay, so I'd like to open up to questions. Anything you want to ask, feel free. Thank you.
Any thoughts, suggestions on anything that can be done to decrease what's become an increasingly crushing burden of basic education for those of us who are in that
Great question. A question that is relevant to me, relevant to a meeting I'm having this coming Saturday night, an area I spend time on, and it's one of the areas of, that I have a lot of focus as far as my own free time, quote unquote, goes. Day school education is a fortune. For the average person, I think it's there's no question. It really takes a crimp out of the budget. Now, out of your budget. A couple of comments. First of all, having spent time really reviewing budgets, and I have an accounting background, and I numbers are something I can relate to. I will tell you that I believe most day schools are reasonably well run. At least the ones that I have been exposed to. I'm not saying everything's perfect. I mean, there's no business that's run perfectly. But it's not as if you're getting a tuition bill and saying, my gosh, these guys must be paying themselves $400,000 a year. This is not like some. Well, I won't go there. You know, there's some charities out there. There have been some bad stories about the last 10, 20 years. It's nothing like that. There's nobody making outrageous amounts of money. And the people are working very, very hard. But the problem is the cost of education is expensive. If you want to give a teacher a living wage, it runs this much money. So to give you an estimate, at least I can give you New York City numbers, that to educate somebody in elementary school, I think runs in the area of $10,000 a student. In high school, it's probably about $15,000 a student. And that's what you have to raise. Now, you can either raise that through tuition, you can raise, or you raise it through donations. And that's basically the equation that's here. So at the end of the day, it's going to be done one way or the other. Now, some schools are very fortunate, can raise 80-90% of their monies by tuitions because they have a more wealthier base of parents, and they're very difficult, will not give breaks. There are other schools who may raise 40% of their money, and they have very, very active fundraising campaigns that are effective. I think the challenge to all of us is relating the importance that we put into Jewish education and translating that into dollars. So what do I mean by that? It's really a responsibility, and it's responsibility onto the wealthier parts of the Jewish community to support Jewish education. You know, it really ties into the comments I made beforehand. If you really believe in a unique destiny, a unique heritage of the Jewish people, you have to invest in that. Now, I would not expect people not of the Jewish faith to be investing because there's no reason they should. You know, they should invest in their own areas that are important for them. But we as a people, as a minority, as a unique ethnic group, have to invest in ourselves. And that could be education across all different boundaries. It could be all different sorts of day schools. It could be adult education programs. But it has to be a priority. And if we don't look out for ourselves, the money won't come there. And what is so difficult for me to understand is that God has blessed us with an unbelievable amount of wealth for the Jewish community in North America. And I know these statistics. I won't go into particulars, but I know the wealth of a lot of individuals. Yet the translation of that into dollars into Jewish education has been abysmal. It's been abysmal. It's I don't know what term to use for it. And the charge and challenge should be is to get as many people who can afford to give excess amount of charities is to invest in your local community primarily, by the way, and invest in education in that area. There are so many good causes out there. And, you know, every day in my door there's good causes out there. But yeah, exactly. But education to me is number one. And people who know me in my community, it's the same story. Local education, that has got to be the number, because you're investing in yourself. You're investing in your children and you're investing in yourself. You've just got to hit the bid. So I would say the challenge in Chicago, and Chicago has a very wealthy community also, is to sensitize those people to how important this is to be committed to Jewish education locally. And over time, you hope you make progress. You know, it may take a year, it may take a few years, but that's I think, the challenge that we all have. Yes.
That question is very interesting because there's currently a program in Chicago where the Federation is trying to do this program, but the ones who are giving the money are within the Orthodox community, and the ones who are sort of going along with it in a minor way are in the non-Orthodox community. And I think differences are significant, number one. And number two, as you're watching the fallout through assimilation and intermarriage and all these other things, you're seeing the Jewish community dilute itself. Two of the movements certainly don't know where they're at, which is the Reform and the Conservative. And the Orthodox, per se, in Chicago, have focused very much in their own milieu, which they should, because what seemingly is happening is in another generation or two, we're going to have a lot fewer Jews, and the only ones who will be left will be with a traditional or an Orthodox background.
Well, that's been right. Well, that's been documented. You know, there's Dick Horowitz. I don't know if you ever gave out. There's a great chart that I mean, it just tells. Look, I have an expression: three strikes and you're out. And I wish it wasn't true what I'm saying, but it is true. Three generations and you're gone. If you don't invest in your families, the chances are overwhelmingly, I don't care if it's 80 or 90 or 95%, your kids are going to be intermarried out, and that's going to be the end of it. And the overwhelming amount of intermarried families do not raise their children as Jews. These are well-known statistics. So if you're Jewish, again, and that goes back to the question, is your Jewish heritage important to you? So a person who's voting not to invest in, means he probably did not invest in his home, and he's not interested in the Jewish people as a group. It's two statements. It's an individual, and it's a group statement. If we're not investing in ourselves, and we don't believe in our uniqueness, then what is your Judaism really worth to you? So you may have a title, you're a Jew, but that doesn't translate into something a tangible. And by the way, your challenge is very well said, because it's not just, so the Orthodox community is very committed. And I know locally about, you know, I'll tell you something, you do IRS tax audits. I was on the phone with somebody this morning, I got off the plane. IRS tax audits will clearly identify you where the largest amounts of charitable contributions as a percent of income come from. And if you look at Orthodox communities throughout this country, they are identified as such. When they do audits on these communities, they know that they should expect a much higher percent going to charity, so they use a different barometer of where they start to do the spot audits vis-a-vis other communities. So this is a documented fact. But the challenge is to expand the space, because I don't care what you, I mean, I care from the perspective I care about, you know, I care that you're Jewish. It's the now that I'm focused on today. If you are Jewish, whether you're affiliated with Reform, Conservative, whatever that may be, none of that is an excuse not to invest in your understanding of your heritage, the Masorah, as we say, and where you come from, and what all these holy books are about. This, I'll get you one second. You know, you have to think about this rationally. You know, I'm a guy, you know, as I mentioned, 50 years old, right? I was making a lot of money in 1992. I mean, it's not a secret. You work in the investment business, you're going to make some money. Why would this idiot leave a job, go to Jerusalem, which in itself was crazy, right? And then spend 50% of his time learning these old, you know, books. And a lot of people probably reacted that way. And yet I'm telling you that that was like the greatest decision of my life. So there's got to be something there. And it's not like I'm looking back 15 years now ago and saying, oh, I wish I would have stayed in Magellan. I've said many times, I've never once said, oh, I wish I would have stayed on Fidelity. I never looked back at it that way. You know, if I want to be in the investment business today full time, I could do it tomorrow, get right back into it. But there's so much more out there, and it's all at your fingertips. And this generation, one other comment, you know, when I went to day school 25 years ago, our teacher base was basically Holocaust survivors, okay? And all the reason they were teaching, and this is true of all the Hebrew schools, by the way, because that's the only job they can have. They had no educational experience. They didn't know what they were doing. They just want to make, and by the way, I'm not blaming them. They had to make a living. Today, you go into the day schools, these teachers, my kids' teachers, are phenomenal. They want to be teachers. These people, so they're being paid 75 grand, 60, 80, whatever the amount, they could be working anywhere else. I'm telling you, making 2, 3, 4 times the amount of money. These are really bright guys. I know the teachers that my kids have, and I'm talking about a couple of different schools, really intelligent people would be extremely successful as lawyers and doctors, and they made a choice that they were going to give to the community and be teachers. Why? How can we not take advantage? So 25 years ago, you could have said to me, where are the teachers? Today, you can't say. They're all over Chicago. They're all over the country. And if you don't find them locally, they're all online. They're international. And it's at your fingertips to take advantage of this. I'm sorry, you had a question.
Yeah, only want to have two children because I can't afford to pay for anymore. And that type of person asks for a scholarship because, let's say, I'm a lawyer and make $100,000 a year, but certainly that's not enough. You know, a $10,000 of grad base, so you put four kids in day school and that's enough.
Right. First of all, it is without a question the greatest control of Jewish population in the Orthodox community in this country relates to what you just said. There's no question. And you, first of all, the most obvious example of that, if you look at the Orthodox community in Israel, it's much greater. And that's not, you know, and it, you know, so within Orthodox, there's different flavors and more. You know, they'll say the ultra Orthodox, the modern, whatever. All these different flavors. That it's irrelevant. In Israel, they all have a lot of kids. I'm not across all boundaries. You go through the Orthodox community, it's 5, 6, 7. We had 5 kids. We were like pikers. You know, forget it. You know, it's like incredible. Because in Israel, because the education is paid for. So there's no question. That is Jewish birth control in this country. Yet there is no East. So what is it? What does that entail at the end of the day? You have to, there's two things. First of all, what you have to hope is that there's somebody at the other end when you go to them with your tuition problem, that they'll be sensitive to the fact to give some sort of discount for multiple children. But on this, but I think the more important point is your own decision. You know, I could have stopped the 3 kids. You know, the decision we had to have our children was not based upon the amount of money. Yes, if I was making, if I couldn't make ends meet, I probably would have stopped. But there probably are things in your life that you maybe have to sacrifice, and that is a difficult thing to do. It's so easy to talk about sacrifice, but when you're used to a certain level of living, that's not an easy thing to do. But that extra child, let's just take one unitary more child, right, may require sacrifices in your life, but you have to think in the big picture, is that worth it? Now, the reason I went through the day school system is my parents sacrificed. My generation, all of our parents sacrificed. The most important thing for all of our parents was to send us to day school. My parents could not, the most money my father ever made when he retired, he worked in the garment industry, was $56,000 a year, and he retired in 1989, and he made a far less than that. My mother was at home the whole time, and there was a real sacrifice. When they paid $2,500 a year for my high school education, that was a real sacrifice, and they paid full tuition. It was not easy, and yet they sacrificed, and that, you know, that was part of the Holocaust generation. They always sacrificed for the kids. So maybe that's somewhat of a challenge on the parents also. How much do you need all the other things in your life, or should you really try to focus as much as possible in trying to put as much as your budget towards that? I will say one other comment, that I am not a rabbi, and I'm not giving Jewish decisor laws here, but I would argue that if you have more children, and you use that money and invest that in tuition, that is clearly tzedakah. That is clearly charity. And you can speak to your local rabbi about it, but I think it's the best investment of charity that a person can make, is having, bringing more Jewish children into the world and having more people in days and more children in day school. Yes.
So